Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
This week on Meat and Three, we're examining the true cost of convenience when it comes to when, where, and how we eat.
Dark stores enable workers to eat without any kind of thought to how they're getting their food or how it might have come to be.
DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft in the past have pledged to spend $90 million to try to exempt themselves from the law.
I could be wrong, but I think there's going to be significant regulatory pushback on driverless trucks.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts. Good morning. We are back in the studio. Today is Thursday, October 10th, and this is the Main Course OG. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here with Patrick Martins, my co-host.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Brandon, thanks for being with us again.
Yeah,
Brandon,
thanks for having me. I'm back.
You're back. You're back. We missed you for a week. And
Where were you?
I was in Miami, Florida. You know the place? I actually have a quick thing about Miami.
Sure.
You get, this is the one place that's already post-apocalyptic. Have you noticed this? It's like in the whole world, this Miami's already post-apocalyptic. There's holes that open up and suck people's trailer park homes into the ground. There's also mosquitoes that bite you and shrink your baby's head. There's have we talked about this before?
Zika?
There's also people who eat people's faces, zombies that eat people's faces.
Which part of Florida do I find those in?
In South Florida. This is happening. What was this? Bath salts? They were taking bath salts and then eating people's faces. Oh, so there's zombies that eat people's faces. There's red algae that's growing everywhere.
And Roberta thinks this is a good place for a new location.
No, I went to a birthday party.
Okay.
But
it's mostly swamp. Florida has so much swamp in it too.
There's also the water could come in, surge in, and an alligator could be trapped inside your house.
I know. I mean, they do have alligators coming up the toilets there. No, that's interesting. The first post-apocalyptic
Patrick's
city
been asking me for a heritage trip to Miami for a year now. I think we're going to rule it out.
It.
I think we're out. No.
In fact, when you got back from Miami for a wedding or something, I asked you, define Miami. And for days, you were like, I can't. It's very complicated to define that city.
It's like Las Vegas with a beach.
Yeah, kind of. And then, where are the older people in Las Vegas? Like out in Henderson?
Are you kidding me? Have you been to Las Vegas? There's old people everywhere. They're all over the place.
Yeah, that's
they're at the off the strip casinos, the Golden Nugget.
Las Vegas population is even older than the farmer median age, which is 72 or something.
The Golden Nugget is awesome, by the way.
It is.
Don't badmouth the Golden Nugget.
Is that a metaphor? Well, we're just back from the North Carolina Meat Conference where we both did a show of the Main Course, and it was really good. We had all these fantastic guests, right? Two chefs, one farmer.
Meat processor,
and one cure master.
Correct. That that was an awesome live. It was a live recording, and it's going to air. It should be up in the podcast store later this week.
It's where I developed my new nickname, Patrick Keynote Speech Martins, and I showed my to-do list, my little chicken scratching post-it note up on a PDF. It was the first time I ever used that or PowerPoint. And I came up with a great line for all these farmers mostly. I was like, did you know YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook are merging into one mega company? And they're like, oh shit, really? I was like, it's called YouTwitface. And they're like, all
someone
right.
used it later on in the day.
Well, they were poking fun at the companies, not at them, you know, but
someone was trying to express their social media presence or lack thereof. And he was like, well, when I do post on YouTwitface, this is what I like to do.
They're terrified by it. Websites, Twitter, Instagram, they're farmers trying to start a sustainable farming operation. And they're so petrified at their inability to work in that world. And it actually keeps them down. I mean,
but this was a really cool conference. It was held in Charlotte. It's called NC Choices. They do it every other year. And it was a mix of farmers, artisans, chefs, and I guess processing companies. It was mostly focused on the pasture-raised, more sustainable movement.
I'm just really looking forward to the, like, farming social media, like, farmers taking selfies on the tractor. Like, just, I just really want it all. Just the like, Miami woman version of, like, farm social media. Just, like, with a glass of rosé on the tractor, just, like, taking a selfie with the pouty lips.
Do you know
and, like, the upward flash angle.
Do you know there are
angle.
Dating apps for geared towards farmers? I think it's called Farmers Only.
That's how Rita Newman met her husband.
Yeah.
So, happy Yom Kippur. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Emily?
You
Yom Kippur.
Are. Happy Jewish New Year to everybody.
Thank you. Did you do anything? How was your breakfast?
My breakfast was excellent. It was filled with lox and
but
bagels
isn't that
and
Rosh Hashanah?
Cream cheese. No, so Rosh Hashanah is the New Year. That was last week.
And then
week.
Yom Kippur is fasting time.
Correct.
Right? And you fasted.
I did. I was not here yesterday. I was off. I was at synagogue. And you are basically, it is the moment where the book is open and it's decided if you will be inscribed in the new book for the new year. So people,
were you inscribed?
I sure hope so. I'm here today.
All right, good.
I woke up this morning. I think that's a good sign, right?
Well, happy year, what is it, 4994 for you or something?
I think it's an even number, actually. I don't know what year it is.
My business strategy of post-dating my checks to the Jewish calendar is starting to backfire. A lot of people are starting to complain. We might not have enough kids to be able to cash a check. So, all right. Well, let's jump into the main.
Yeah, we have our first segment is the weekly based. And we're going to jump in with a game of word association and introduce you to all of our guests. We have selected two words or terms for each person with us today and ask that you respond in 15 seconds or less. This did not go over well at the conference this week. 15 seconds turned into about a minute and a half per person. So first we have Jack Log. Is it Log? Loge?
Log.
Logue, Jack Logue, the executive chef of the Clock Tower at the Edition, and a fellow New York City kid, or man, young man, adult man. So, your word association is mom and pop.
Let's go noble, hardworking, razor-thin margins, and you've got mail.
You've got mail.
Ooh,
Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan.
Reference.
That's right.
No, so why you've got mail reference. Also with Tom Hanks.
Oh,
and Meg Ryan.
Yeah, wow.
You've Got Mail took place in New York.
Oh, I see.
It's a real mom and pop story there.
Oh, I see. I didn't ever see the movie. I just figured you were talking about people who still have Hotmail as their email account or something.
All right, your next word is clubs.
Because your Clock Tower is like a club. I mean, you feel like you're in an old catcher's mitt there.
Yeah, basically.
But this wasn't a question for you, Patrick.
Sorry. But I just want to say the reason we gave you the word club is because you're essentially operating a club. Billiard tables.
In a lot of ways, yeah. Although whenever I hear clubs, I have to go back to the summers of 2005 and 2006 because I pretty much spent my summer nights in clubs. I don't want to go back there anymore.
Pre-tunnel, right? The tunnel didn't exist in 2005, did it?
Yeah, but we didn't say that duck club. We said the club.
You're talking about meatpacking.
Duck right. club is much better than the club, right?
We were thinking more like club chairs, billiards
rackets.
Rooms. Well,
lots of rackets.
Clock Tower has a lot of these cool, small, like cozy rooms for drinking, for socializing, for dining.
Yeah, we're kind of a unique spot in that regard because, you know, I think we're the only Michelin star restaurant with a pool table in it. So
there you go.
Whatever that's worth.
That's amazing.
Brandon, can we find you in that club?
You would love it.
I would be up in that club, no doubt.
You would love it.
Definitely, with like an air horn. Do you think that would be appropriate?
Come on.
Like, also, I hope there's no dress attire because everyone knows that I wear like pretty much sweatpants and t-shirts.
Yeah, you're in a hotel. That's the beauty of hotels and why the service is so great. You can get a club sandwich in the elevator if you ask somebody. You know, they'll really break rules for you.
I did just stay at the Edition in Miami.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful.
I recently went to there's a new Edition in Times Square, and I don't think I've ever said this before, but you feel like you're like outside of New York. It's this little oasis. You walk in, you go up to the 9th floor. They have this terrace restaurant, and first of all, the Edition has its own scent. So you already have this like mental, you know, association that you're away and you're outside of the hecticness of New York City and Times Square. You hear a little bit of jackhammering, but overall you're like away.
A lovely part of New York where Clock Tower is too, just at the base of Madison Avenue. So you have, it's a real special little nugget, golden nugget. All right, next.
Next, we have Dan Miller, the CEO of Steward, which enables people to invest directly in sustainable farms. Steward is based in Portland and in London. Hey, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So hello. Your word, is he suddenly British?
American accent. I'm working on the English one.
So your word is, or term, return on investment.
It's about getting a yield on not putting up capital, but also your time and effort into something. So I find return on capital, but also the yield that farmers get when they put their efforts in.
Cool. Your other one is longevity.
So Steward, the name was created for the idea of longevity with the farms, people thinking beyond their lifetime and their life cycle. So kind of stewardship and longevity go well together.
Awesome.
Now, is that the big problem you would say in terms of the investment world, is they have short-term goals and not long-term goals? Is that what Wall Street is?
Yeah, that's generally the case. And with farming, you have to think so long-term. And so you have to put not only your money, but your time into future planning. And most investments are looking for short-term. So I think we're just trying to get people to understand they need to not only put their money to these farms, but they need to be patient and see them grow.
It's like very few people are patient, you know, like most people are like, oh, I'm going to work at this job for 5 years. But if you're going to work it the whole life or keep an investment for your whole life, then these type of investments are the good ones. If you're in and out and whatever your guy tells you, you're pulling your money here, you know, then sure.
That's how we feel.
The next quarter.
They're stable. It's land. It's long term. And I think we found that the farmers are committed to this for life. So they just want to get funding to move forward. You know, they're taking the long road.
Now, is this Portland, Maine, or Portland, Oregon?
Oh,
Portland,
very good question.
Oregon.
Great.
Well, we like both on this show. We're fans of both. But
there was one thing that David Newman quoted me as having said once, which I didn't remember. I say, if you go to a doctor's office and you see a Mercedes outside, you're like, good job. If you see a Mercedes outside a farm, you're like, that guy's getting paid too much. Wow. You know, I mean, that's what I think the general thought is. Oh, this farmer, what's he charging for his pigs? He's driving a Mercedes. You know, it should be opposite, actually.
But if he had like a $150,000 tractor, how would you feel?
That's okay. That's true.
Actually, I was going to say most farm equipment costs way more than a car. So we don't have the knowledge.
The air conditioned combine where you're literally burning oil to warm yourself inside of a machine that's spreading oil.
All right. Our next round is, we like this game, Fuck, Marry, Kill. We have London.
No, we don't like this game. I don't know why you always prefer this game.
I was actually
going to
say,
nobody
likes this game.
Brandon, this is the only time Brandon questioned in history, this category of question, where Brandon's like, could you repeat it? I want to give an educated answer. So, go.
We're going to repeat it. Would you? Do you know the question? Are you familiar?
London, New York, Portland.
Jack, you start.
Me? Yeah. All right. Definitely gonna fuck Portland. I've never been, so that's something new. Seems pretty fun. Seems pretty cool. Up and coming, you know.
Good.
Pretty much down for whatever. I guess I gotta marry New York though, because it's my home. So it means that the place that I represent as a professional chef, I gotta kill. London's out.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. London's been bombed before.
Dan, you're part time in London or full time?
I will say, for me, definitely fuck New York. It's a volatile place. There's a lot of emotions here. Got stuck in a canal for 15 minutes on the L train.
So. Passion. We call it passion.
Then I'd want to marry both London and Portland, but I'd probably say Portland has better ethics. So I'll marry Portland.
Thinking with your wallet, huh? She's like, I got all my money there. I can't kill that.
Brandon's your favorite game. You got to chime in.
Oh, man. I hate this game. Why did he force me into this?
So many options.
I know. I mean, I'm probably I probably marry New York. I think. I know very little about London, so I guess I'll fuck London. Portland is such a... I feel so horrible. Like, I've done something wrong if I'm going to kill Portland. It's just such a nice place. So nice people. Can I fuck them both? Like a menage
sure.
a trois?
Yeah, yeah. You got
I'm
it.
I'm going to have a menage a trois with
you
London
can be in
and
a
Portland.
Thruple.
A thruple. Mmm. Let's fuck them all.
I love Portland, but the people there are so dirty, you know. I would have to kill it. And London, you know, it'd be like fucking Dame James Duty Judy Dench or one of these great actresses. Duty, Duty Dench. Anyway. All right.
Did you just say Duty Stench?
He just said no. Duty on air. Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Let's talk mentors.
Yeah. Who is the most important person you have ever met in your field? Dan, you want to start?
I mean, for me, it's Wendell Berry. I've not met him, but I am very inspired by him. I would like to meet him. I guess I'll have to go to Kentucky to meet him.
So that's an interesting... you've read his books?
Oh, his books inspired me. I mean, he's the thinker behind it all.
Yeah? So, there's the way he's like... What is he? The American poet, isn't he? About agriculture.
Agrarian poet, I guess. Yeah.
Amazing.
Chef Jack?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've been really, really lucky to have met some of my own mentors and worked for them. So, I mean, Daniel Blewett has to be one of them. Working with him was one of the best experiences of my life. Neil Perry in Australia, and then currently working with and for Chef Jason Atherton. You know, all of them successful not only as chefs but also entrepreneurs, which is what I'd like to do with my career in the future, and to work with them and see them as human beings and people and family men, as well as chefs, as well as businessmen, and watch their success has been both inspiring and very, very, you know, gives me a blueprint and a path, hopefully.
It's nice that you say family man, that like that is something that you've come across in the mentors that you work with. So often in this industry and with chefs, that's not prioritized. So that's
yeah,
really nice that you've had that
part,
image.
You know, to figure out how to balance that, and something that means a lot to me as a person as well, and figuring out how to do that. You know, I've been divorced through this industry, so like I have a second chance now with my fiance. So I want to like, that is a focus of mine.
Hey, Brandon, I'm actually interested in how you would answer to this. Who's the top person in your field? Like, who have you learned the most from to run Roberta's?
Well, what is my field?
Restaurateur.
Oh, okay. So we've narrowed my field down.
Sorry, and basketball player.
I was
going to
say wiffle. I was going
to
say wiffle ball.
Yeah, wiffle
expert.
Ball. Yeah, like maybe professional wiffle ball player, flag football player. I'm a lot of things that most people don't know. Sorry, what's the question again?
Who's your mentor?
Mentor.
Who did you ever go into a place and study with a guy for like a month and be like, this is how I learned the trade?
No, but I would say like some of the most influential, like Alice Waters was very influential to us and to me in the early days, and her presence here and like having her around was very influential. And I think like just like philosophically coming from the Bay Area and coming from that place, like she was probably somebody that like philosophically I could like kind of relate to and understand. She was probably the most influential in the early days for me. I think as time goes on, you find people, and for me, it's usually these people aren't in my field. I usually look outside of my field to be influenced and to kind of like gain more knowledge, because it's like unfortunately in your field it becomes a box and people start to do the same things over and over again. And I like to look outside into other fields, you know, to try to gain perspective on what you do.
Dan?
Who inspires
you
me
told
most?
You. Wendell Berry.
Wendell Berry.
Oh, Wendell Berry. Sorry, Jack, we did.
He's worth talking about twice.
Sorry.
So I was going to say, also in the studio with us today is Chef Will Devlin, yeah. Chef owner of The Small Holding, which is a restaurant in Kent, England.
Were you on London time when you came to this? You were.
I was pretty
you
late, wasn't I? Let's be honest.
5.5 hours early.
I wasn't going to blow up your spot, but you know, Patrick wanted to correct the Boreham Hill time is not London time.
Sorry, man. I do apologize to everyone.
I was early.
A late. But I've come over from England. We came a couple of days ago. We've just came to eat and hang out, and we've been to a couple of restaurants so far, and we're going to go to some more throughout our trip. We're up to the Hudson Valley like tomorrow, Friday.
Cool. And so who would you say is a mentor? Who's the most important person you've ever met in your field?
Like worked with a guy called Richard Phillips. He used to run for Marco Pierre White back in London. He also worked for the Roux brothers for years, and I worked with him for like 7 years, and kind of took my management position in kitchens through to sort of running the kitchen, to running a site, to really kind of understanding how the business works as well, rather than just the kitchen.
So not Dame Judi Dench.
Not Dame Judi Dench. No, never met her. But Dench. I do like, so I met Jason at a thing called Pub in the Park in the UK. We both did a cooking demo. And, you know, I thought he was going to be quite hard, but actually he was super cool. And exactly like you said, family man. He brought his kids and his wife with him and we hung out. My wife was there with my daughter. So it was nice. It's people like that influenced me, like from just meeting him, understanding how he kind of must run a pretty tight ship, but also always make time for what's important as well.
Very good. We also have another guest in the studio. So this is a really guest-filled show.
I wish that we were also like live on YouTube or had a video stream for this one. We have a pretty full house today.
We have Uli Sitter, who is sitting right next to Emily of Uli's Oil Mill, who dropped in studio with a little taste of pumpkin oil. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Pumpkin oil. It's grown in upstate New York in the Finger Lakes.
And is this for your face? Or can you use this for everything? I'm going to ask you the same question every time you come on the show.
It's meant to be drizzled.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for having me. Well, you can for sure put it on your face. It's just a tiny little greenish, so maybe you do it in the evening. But it's very nourishing.
I look good in green.
Yeah, it all is your taste. So this is the only organic and locally grown pumpkin seed oil, stamp pressed in the Austrian tradition. And this is very unique because usually your Austrian-style pumpkin seed oil is just imported. And over the years, it is a lot of seed infrastructure behind it and a lot of capital investment. We have these pumpkin seeds now grown here in the Finger Lakes, and I stamp press it in Long Island City. So a very famous regional Austrian-Styrian specialty is now local to New York and New York City.
So is the process, Austrian process, more important than the ingredient being grown in Austria? So terroir over terroir?
It's the same, you know, the seed, you can grow it here.
Okay.
But the process, you know, you need to cut the seeds, you add some salt and water, you roast it for 1 hour, then you stamp press it. So you can only do it in a stamp press, and usually your oil is chemically extracted or expeller pressed, like from biodiesel background. So you need to have the variety and the process.
Do you do the work yourself, or do you pay people to? How many hours are you in the plant? What do you call it? The shed?
It's the oil mill. Room? The oil mill. So I press on demand seeds you can store, usually 12 months under ideal conditions. But once you press an oil, you want to have it as fresh as possible.
So then how many days, like in a month, are you there for 5 days a week?
It all depends on your orders.
I see.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but this should be the time of year that you would harvest the most seeds that you will store for next year's production?
No, so you let them rest maybe for 1 month or so, and then you start producing.
So can I like sell you my Halloween pumpkin at the end?
Well, it's a different variety. This is
always trying to get some money out of the show.
No, so this is not your jack-o'-lantern pumpkin, the orange pumpkin. So Columbus did bring these pumpkins to Europe 200 years ago, like potatoes, like coffee, like many other things. But there was a natural mutation occurring, and people realized in Austria there was a hulllessness, and there was Georg Mendel around the plant breeding, and they specialized on hulllessness and oil richness. So it's it's a Styrian, an Austrian pumpkin variety. It's completely different than your orange pumpkin.
I see. Well, very interesting. So, Uli, I'll ask this question to you and then the rest of the panel. So in this oil world, what is your most reliable source for important information regarding your field of work? So to learn about this field, is there a newsletter, a website, word of mouth? What is it?
The Austrians.
Just the Austrians.
No, it's the seed culture. You know, here at farmers markets, people come, oh, is this infused olive oil? No, olive oil. There are no olive trees. You have in a healthy grain crop rotation, you can grow all these seeds. In Celtic Europe, you know, you had in Britain, you have your raps, your rapeseed oil. Yeah. You have sunflower oil. This is like for thousands of years, they had a local vegetable oil source, and it's non-existent here. So you need to build it up.
It's like Wesson. Yeah, it's the worst. Chef Jack?
Yeah, actually kind of piggyback on what Brendan was saying. For a while there, I really didn't want to know much about what was going on because I wanted to try to find some inspiration myself, and if you you are always too tapped into the scene, or like what's new or what's hot or what's fresh and what everyone's using, then I think it becomes so homogenous. And it's a risk that we run in New York City a lot, I think, you know, because everyone kind of taps onto the same trend and then you see it everywhere and then it just goes away. So I try not to listen to too much, although Heritage Radio is now going to be my new source of all information.
Good answer. Patrick, I know you were trying to make a sale off that.
Yeah. Well, every time someone, I also worry, I think that just like you said, but then I think I'm also just being lazy and I'm like just trying to avoid reading or something.
Well, yeah. You are doing both, actually. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I'm like, this way I don't have to read. I don't want my creative juices to be stomped out.
Right.
So what about you?
For me, it's going and meeting the farmers and actually talking to them directly, mm-hmm. seeing what they need, tasting their products, figuring out how to support them. So that's my favorite part, traveling around.
Now, what part, what will you look for in a farmer? What kind of like of those magical tricks do you have in your trade to know that you're not investing in a one trick pony or someone who's just saying the right things, but maybe not doing the right things for the long term?
So their passion is number one. These types of farmers that are obsessed about their products are just so passionate. So we meet them on the farm. It's really easy to feel that inspiration from them. Also, if they've established themselves a little bit in some local markets, they have some sales at local restaurants, they're actually already producing something. And so we're generally funding those farmers that are producing Heritage products that need funding to help grow their business. They're already somewhat established, but it's that next step where they can't get funding to buy land, irrigation equipment, etc.
So can you give us an example of a farm that you've invested in that's successful?
Sure. One of the first farms we funded was an urban farm in Detroit. They've been operating on a 20-tenth of an acre of leased land. They wanted to buy more land. They were having trouble getting funding because an urban farm is, you know, not a traditional farm. So we provided funding for them to buy a few acres of land. Their sales have gone up about 5-6 times in the past year. They're supplying local restaurants, you know, about a half mile from the farm. And they've transformed what was a bunch of vacant lots with trash strewn into a community hub. So, you know, you see the tangible improvements. You see that they can achieve their livelihood. And most of these farmers get stuck at that point where they can't get to the scale they need to have enough income to support themselves.
Mm-hmm. Got it. But what about you, Will? Where do you get your information as a chef in London?
Well, I'm in a tiny village called Kilndown. It's like there's like 15 houses there. And then we've got the small holding. So to be honest, the majority of inspiration is taken from the farm. Like it's on the same site. So literally we can see it from the kitchen window. So we're down there, we're seeing what's growing, we're seeing what's coming through. And also, I think most of the inspiration, you say you're working with farmers, you start to see the produce that you don't see in the grocery store or the supermarket. So like the cauliflower leaves and the dill seeds and like the fennel tops and all of the bits that get kind of trimmed off and put aside before we get to the market. So for me, it's that kind of inspiration, using ingredients that we can't normally get our hands on. And yeah, just kind of working with the land a little bit.
Patrick, where do you get your information from, huh?
I'm actually 1,000% word of mouth, I think. I mean, I'm probably 80% word of mouth, although I do read the paper every day.
You read the New York Times every morning.
But I don't read the articles. I just see what's happening. And I will read an article. But I basically think it's word of mouth. Think about it. All the chefs, all the farms, it's all phone. Mm-hmm. And text if it needs to be. We actually prefer it to be phone.
Which is funny because I most of the time you're not listening to people. You're sitting there thinking, what's the next thing you're going to say to somebody?
I know. I'm like, when can I interrupt?
I was pausing. I was not interrupting. I was letting you complete your thought.
I thought you were doing a comic thing. Because you know what the secret of comedy is, right?
Timing.
So what is your earliest food memory?
Yeah, who are we going to start with?
Who comes from the oldest culture? I think us here in the United States.
Absolutely, of course. Chef Will, how do you want to start?
Everyone's looking at me. For earliest food culture, it's got to be cooking with my dad, or my mum and dad. In a massive family, but there was like 6 of us growing up. So we had like dinner time. It's not like quintessential, like I used to bake with my nan and stuff. But like seriously, we used to get involved with the cooking. So one would be chopping something, making a salad. That kind of, everything started with onions and garlic, like that kind of beginning of smell of the kitchen. I think that's the beginning of most of the food that we cooked. It was pretty simple, whether it was a bolognese or a chili con carne or something like that. But yeah, it was hustle and bustle and people shouting.
Well,
and,
there's one culture that's universally considered one of the very best for food. It's England. Sorry.
You're allowed to punch him, Chef. You're allowed to hit him for that one.
Come on.
All right, so I'm ready. I've got thick skin, don't worry.
Dan, you're living in London. Can you vouch for that statement?
London's changed a lot.
England and London, city?
You know, they're different places. For me, it was growing up, going out crabbing with my father in the mornings out on the Chesapeake Bay, getting some Maryland blue crabs, having big cookouts with our family, steam crabs, sweet corn, tomatoes, all the good stuff. So that was my connection.
And you wanted to get into agriculture as a result of those memories?
Yeah, I think so. My mom's family's been farming since the late 1800s in Eastern Shore, Maryland. So I grew up in D.C. but had that connection. And you saw what was a diversified farm economy just collapse from big ag and soy and corn and broiler chickens and all that exciting stuff. So I, you know, steward for me was how can I provide resources to the farmers that want to do good work in those types of communities, and then realize that same kind of industrial destruction is across the whole country and world. So my personal story is really many of the same story in people's home regions.
Hmm. Chef?
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky to have grandmothers on both sides of my family who were really talented cooks. But one thing that's unique, or someone growing up in New York, my dad's actually from Kentucky. And so his dad was a farmer, actually, up until about like last year. You know, at 86, I think he finally stopped going to the farm every day.
Wow.
But his wife, you know, is a phenomenal cook, my grandmother, and their parents were phenomenal cooks. And so having my Granny Lester's fried chicken will always be like my first like mind-blown food memory. And it was, you know, I would be out playing sports all the time and like out in the fields and everything like that. My granddaddy would come home from the farm. We'd all sit down, you know, probably like 20 of us, and then we'd have this fried chicken, and it was just like everyone was skillet fried, you know, in the dark skillet, and it was just super delicious. And then on the other side, you gotta have grandmother's meatballs. So a Puerto Rican lady learning how to cook her mother-in-law's Italian meatballs is,
oh wow,
priceless, right?
Puerto Rico and Italian.
Do you have an homage to either of those dishes? Have you ever put them on your menu?
Not in the way I probably should at some point, you know, but I feel like that'll be more of a personal thing when I do. Yeah.
Cool.
Uli, oldest food memory?
I don't know. I went with the empty milk can to the farmer next door, and, you know, of course, we would drink all that unpasteurized milk.
Mm-hmm.
And walking into our little town and picking up the bread from my aunt, who was a baker, and it's a 900-year-old recipe, you know, from a monastery. So food was all around. We grew red currants, cherries, we made sauerkraut, you know, apple juice, whatever, you know, it was.
Sure. Well, I'll say that was would have been my answer. Milk, of course. That's what the only thing you eat for a year when you start. And I do think milk needs to be preserved. This is a great idea, and it's nice to see that it's starting to take off. You know, almond milk, oatmeal milk, and all that. That's not really milk, because like a nut does not lactate. So I think they should spell it the same. This is the great compromise. Spell it the same, but it's a soft K. So milsh. Oat milch.
We got a text from one of our chefs the other day.
Maybe it needs to be spelled M-I-L-C-H, but then everyone's happy.
That's German for milk, so.
Oh, is it? All right, well. If Uli okays it, maybe we can
apparently,
start a movement.
We got a text photo from one of our chefs, Evan Tesler, the other day, and it was called Malk, M-A-L-K. And he writes, kind of like milch, you think? It is gum-free, gluten-free, oil-free, cold-pressed, unsweetened oat and almond milk. I don't think that's going to last very long.
They got to tighten that up.
That's, yeah.
That is not very proper branding.
You would not invest in that. So what do you guys do for charity?
Yeah, I'll take this one.
Chef Jack?
Yeah, so, you know, with the restaurants, we do many different things in the community, like Madison Square Park and Tastes of Gramercy. And, you know, I'm doing one for Autism Speaks next week, which is a really awesome. But personally, and
yeah, personally,
I'm very invested in, it's actually with No Kid Hungry and Share Strength. I'm on the Chef Host Committee with the No Kid Hungry in New York, and I've been doing it now for about 7 or 8 years, and it's really just a great organization. And what I think is unique about it, not unique, that's kind of condescending, but it actually gets a lot of legislation done. You know, we do go to Capitol Hill, we went to Albany, we got things passed, and I feel like doing charity and having these fun events, but then also seeing the legislative side work out is really what's rewarding for this one.
Oh, it really humbles me. Mine was that I'm friends with Brandon. That was my charity.
And you do a lot of charitable work with me.
Yeah.
Like, keep me standing.
Give me $5 when you need it.
Give me something to do on Thursday morning.
Chef Will, what about you? Charities?
Yeah, we work with a couple of charities. The main one we work with is a charity called Pilot Light, which is a hospitality mental health charity. It was set up by a couple of friends of mine that have both gone through some stuff. And then they kind of wanted to change stuff. And they kind of looked down at some younger chefs and realized that there was a problem, right? And there's a drug problem, alcohol problem, loneliness problem, all of those things. And so we do some fundraising, we do some charity dinners, The main thing is just shed, like pilot light. It's shedding the light to sort of let the guys know it's okay. We work, it's a national thing in the UK, but I'm an ambassador for it in Kent. So it's about kind of bringing the scene a little bit closer. We're not like New York where there's loads of restaurants everywhere. Things are a bit more spread out. So kind of bring a community for the chefs to kind of spend time with each other on their days off, realize they're not alone, realize they don't have to just go to the pub and get drunk. Like they can kind of do productive things and kind of, yeah, share, spend time with each other. So Pilot Light is the charity that we work with.
That's pretty serious.
That's awesome.
Yeah, sorry, got a bit deep.
No, I like it.
Emily, don't tell your one where you just allow them to round up to the nearest dollar at your Walmart checkout. That is not after that.
You're talking
after
about these the two guys. App called Acorns? Which is...
Round up. I'm not rounding anything up at the Walmart. I can't believe they asked that.
So for me, we have a foundation at Steward called the Steward Foundation that gives grants to the farmers to do work in their local region. A lot of the farmers are doing research around climate resiliency and how to farm with less water and in more sustainable way. So we just try to link up with the farmers on the ground and let them do their work.
Fantastic.
We are going to take a very quick break, and then we will be back with a little bit more from Will, Dan, and Jack and Uli. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Harvest Homecoming, an old-school fall foliage festival, comes to Brooklyn Botanic Garden on Sunday, October 20th. Celebrate cider season with New York cider houses and kombucha makers, bringing hard and soft ciders and fermented drinks to try or buy. A pop-up farmers market will feature heritage apples from local orchards. Groove to the sounds of fresh Americana music and world beats throughout the day. Bring your friends and family and make a day of it with hay rides, lawn games, a children's Halloween costume parade, and more, all in the heart of Brooklyn. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We have a full house today. If you've been listening, we have Jack, Will, Dan, and Uli with us. So Will Devlin of the closest town I know is Kent. I don't remember the name of your town in England. We read and heard that you grow and raise most of your ingredients. You have a restaurant called The Small Holding. What is one thing that it's just not worth the headache to make or grow yourself?
There's a question. I don't know.
He's obviously not read the outline.
To be honest, like there's certain things that you churn through, like stock vegetables, right? Let's be honest, we're all chefs. If you're chopping a mirepoix for a stock or something to braise, or like when I buy a lot of that stuff from the farmers, like so local farms, I buy carrots and onions.
So carrots, onion, celery, it's leaks, not that worth kind of, to
celery's
grow.
Difficult.
Basically anything in the mirepoix, not worth.
We had
worth.
A problem, but we do grow them. We do grow them. We just use them as a little bit more special than just chop them up into a stock. We only have an acre, right? So when we're growing carrots, that kind of kills me a little bit to just,
maybe you need to hit Dan up for some
land in Portland.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. But so we do.
No, you know, an investor to maybe take on another small holding next door.
We do need it. Well, we've just signed up to
double the acreage.
We just signed up to another farm that's literally, I don't know, 500 yards down the road, and that's 40 acres. So we're going to be into dairy and some more grazing room for our sheep and stuff like that. So, but anyway, the things that we don't grow are stock vegetables. I think is the easiest way of saying that, but we grow them individually. We just showcase them a little bit more. It's a little bit more special. Do you know, you
the other thing you don't grow is goat, right? But are you participating in Goat-tober?
We love Goat-tober over in the UK, right? It's a really underused meat, and obviously goat's cheese is so prolific in the UK as everywhere now. James dropped off a goat last week, so we've got it on as part of our, we don't do canapes, we do like snacks. So when you sit down, you get a cocktail or a beer. We give you a little platter of snacks before you start, and they're kind of all goat-based.
Cool.
So Goat-tober's wicked. We love being part of that.
Awesome. Goat-tober was started to stop food waste in the food system because male dairy goats were euthanized at birth oftentimes. Yeah. So that's why we started the project.
Yeah, we started at Heritage Foods. No kid left behind. That's no it, goat left behind. Amazing. 9 years ago, and it has traveled across the Atlantic, and our good friend James Butler across the pond.
Yeah, and I think they're just starting to do some bits in Trinidad and Tobago. Yeah, they're going worldwide. It was out in Australia. So.
Just with that, that's so typical English. They go to the place where the goat's been around for 10 million years and like colonize a project that they've just naturally been doing. They're like, that was our idea.
I'm going to get it all day.
So, Dan, tell us more about Steward, and what's the greatest challenge you face getting what you... So, what's the greatest challenge you face with Steward?
So, Steward was created to allow people to invest in sustainable farms. They can go to gosteward.com and make an investment directly.
Hmm.
What we found the challenge is that farmers have lots of opportunities to sell their products. There's more demand and awareness for what they have. But it's still very hard for them to get capital and particularly funding that's flexible to their needs as a specific farm, not just a standardized, you know, commodity farming. And so we found that, that the biggest challenge we have is making people aware and letting them understand that they can do more than just buy products from these farmers. They can actually provide the investment funds for those farmers to succeed. And the idea is creating these regional communities that products are sold directly, that those people are also funding the farmer, and you create these small microeconomic loops. Whereas right now there's a global, you know, food system, which is probably not the most efficient way to do things. And it's better to keep it local with the capital and the product.
Is it like Kickstarter where you sort of are then more in touch with that farmer? You're more in the know about what's going on, or you have a relationship? Or is it more just knowing that you're doing good and helping someone grow their business?
No, the goal is to really link people with the farms, have them understand them. But it's actually an investment platform. So people get a return on their investment. They get dividends and interest payments from the investments that they make. But they can come to the website, they can see all the different farms, they can select individual farms, they can visit those farms. So it's really about creating those narratives and tying people together. And then what we found, I mean, this is what this network's created, is that more people are trying to get involved and more people are interested in supporting these farms. So we just try to make it easy to find them. And looks like today we got our first farm in the UK.
What percentage of the money you raise goes to the farms?
100%. It goes right through.
So then who? How do you guys make your piece? I mean, if money is made and dividends are paid, you take a share of the dividend?
We charge the farmers, the borrower, a one-time 2% loan origination fee when the loan is created. And then for investors, there's no fee to make an investment, and they pay 1% per year servicing fee. So if they invested at 8%, 1% would go to us and 7% for them.
I would never ask this of a for-profit business, but since you have to publish it legally anyway, what are you guys, a $10 million business, a $5 million business? I mean, what bracket are you in?
So far, we've made 16 loans to farmers across the U.S. We've had one in Europe to a Swiss winemaker, natural winemaker.
I didn't know if you'd already made the investment in his farm.
No, we don't have it.
It's coming. There's a handshake agreement.
Give us 90 days. We'll be back.
It's a high-tech world. Okay, 16. Wow, that's impressive.
And then $2.2 million overall. And then last week, we just launched the platform for investors. So anyone can come to the website, gosteward.com.
Very interesting.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Everyone, we encourage you to check out gosteward.com. Jack, executive chef of Clock Tower, how do you define born and raised New Yorkers? And tell us about what you're trying to do with your menu at the Clock Tower.
Yeah, I think born and raised New Yorkers, we grow up quickly. I think it's something that has actually helped me very much in my professional life, you know, because at, you know, age 26, 27, when I was the executive sous chef and chef de cuisine of Bettany, and then now as a chef at, you know, not at old age, you basically have to be the adult in the room all the time. And, you know, I have 70, 75 employees who are looking to me to make all the, you know, decisions, and you have to be the adult in the room. And I
think you have to be a judge, fair. You have to be fair.
Absolutely, and you have to keep the, you know, the positivity in the kitchen, and, you know, keep everybody being honest and positive and having right attitudes. You're solving problems all day long. I mean, that's what being a chef is, right? You're basically just solving one problem after another.
Yeah,
and, you know, you're trying to use your best judgment, and I think that it really grounds you and humbles you. And I think that's what growing up in New York does as well, because, you know, by age 14 or 15, you're having your first beer, your first, you know, whatever. And, you know, by the time you get to college and everyone else is doing it, you're like, yeah, I don't need to do that anymore. Like, I'm going to do something a little bit more serious or some more fun or enjoy the outdoors or whatnot. I think that it reflects in the professional sector as well.
So you were like me, we would go to a Japanese restaurant and then everyone would put the cash down that they thought they owed and you would be like $280 short. it would forward to Edward Piketty Chompy in my school to pay for
everything. I have not thought about that in years. That used to always happen. Everyone was like, I'm pretty sure I only owe $40.
Yeah. I'm like
you get to the end and you're like, you got whoever's sitting there last.
Whoever's the last one standing is done. That's
I'm like, my three sacchettinis, here's $12. Have a great day. I got to leave.
Oh, my God. I haven't thought about that in a long time.
The amount of restaurants that we've closed down.
Yeah.
As, you know. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, there are also, you know, certain bars that city kids learn that they just didn't care if you were underage. So, and then what about your menu? Is there some New Yorker-ness that you put on your menu? Or is it Kentucky roots? Or
No, definitely. I mean, something I want to do in whatever my next project is actually trying to establish and find like the identity of New York cuisine. I think it's a really fun thing that some people have tried, and I really want to go into that. But for now at Clock Tower, we have a really cool thing we're actually switching over to, like really taking on a lot of British, kind of not classics in their composition, but you know, classics in what they are and how they can be, you know, utilized, but then making them very, very modern and progressive and utilizing all the New York ingredients and really like showing that marriage between, you know, Jason Atherton's roots in Britain, mm-hmm. and also my roots in New York, and kind of weaving that in. So it's actually a really fun thing. We've just started it over the last couple of months. And
Will, it sounds like you need to make a stop at the Clock Tower while you're here.
Yeah, we're back in Manhattan in like on the 18th, 19th.
Yeah, it's perfect.
So yeah,
come on. Old cricket padding, leather. You know, it's like a leather mitt over there. It's very, very nice.
And Uli, what's next for you, and why is oil so important? Why should our listeners be excited about this pumpkin oil?
Well, I make other oils as well. It's just your local and healthy, source of, you know, vitamins, you know, flavor. It has so much in it. All these oils, they're so complex, and you drizzle it over as a finishing oil, or you just put it on your face. You have these press cakes as proteins for baking or meat wraps. It's endless, and it's just empowering the local farmers, the local, you know, society, building up an infrastructure, not to just have these investment banking jobs to certain sectors, a more even society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, biodiversity, my camelina oil, 4,000-year-old plant from Celtic Europe, 38% of omega-3. It's a local plant-based omega-3 source and attracts 80 different wild bees, so it's just a more beautiful.
If you take over with your idea, I mean, you're going to overturn the American economy. You're going to be 50,000 times worse than Elizabeth Warren to Wall Street. Everything's going to be local, traded there.
Yeah, and all the cosmetics, think about that. You have all, whatever, you know, you have in
you,
this
you don't
product.
Test on animals, do you, at your oil mill?
But I test on myself.
That's right, right.
She's looking a little green today. Yeah. She's testing on herself. Can we taste the pumpkin oil as we?
Oh yeah, we'll give you
up
our honest opinion. Word association. Well, everyone gets one word, with possible dashes.
Okay, let's drizzle it.
That would have been a much nicer photo if I was just. Yes, okay.
It does leave a little bit of a green color on your skin.
Delicious.
Yeah, I like it.
Warmth.
I taste peanut. No? No one else does? Pumpkin, obviously.
Chef Will's thinking over there. Is this I read that you grow at the small holding 200 fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, we grow some pumpkins, but not the same. So I've used... so we used to make a... I don't remember the name of the variety in English, but we used to make a souffle with these green pumpkin seeds.
Yeah.
And then we drizzled the oil in the top, over the top of the ice cream, and it was amazing. That just took me back to that memory. So,
yes.
It's kind of caramelly, toasty, like malty slightly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, delicious.
And this is the press cake. So I press so gently with my 1-ton stamp press, 5 kilos in one batch. So I have a very, you know, valuable side product, and it's for baking, for, but you can taste it too.
Patrick, what's your
word?
Not
too much. For this?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it has the, even though it's an oil, it has the thickness of peanut butter almost. It has the texture of peanut butter. So it goes to show that a natural plant can create such a thick, what is peanut butter? It is a butter.
It's a protein.
No, but it's a fabric. The texture of peanut butter is spreadable. This is almost a spreadable oil. You almost picture your knife like that. If you flipped your knife at an angle, it wouldn't just slide off. This is heavy. It has substance.
I know what you mean. I think my word is my word is nutty. Even though it's not.
All right, guys. Well, this has been a great show.
Yeah, thank you all for joining us. We hope you will all take the time to visit the Clock Tower, visit the small holding, learn more about Stewart, and check out Uli's Oil Mill. And stick around for Taste of the Past up next, and we'll be back next week. Happy Go-tober. The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.